The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Well, welcome to Storytelling in the Classroom. I hope that is all where you thought you were. If not, it's okay to leave. So let's pray, and we will get started. Gracious and mighty God, we have listened. We have sat at your feet. Our brains are reaching capacity. We are full. We are tired. But yet we yearn for more. So, Father, I pray that you would open our hearts, that you would open our minds, that you would give us practical words to walk forward with. Father, I pray that my words would be clear, that they would be easily absorbed, that they would benefit those who hear them. Father, I pray that this afternoon would grant us excitement and refreshment, that we would leave this place excited about the task that you have given us to do. Father, it is a lofty task, and we ask that you would meet us where we are, that you would energize us, that you would equip us, and that you would prepare us for the year ahead. In your name we pray. Amen. My name is Tricia Dietrich. I am a grammar school teacher. I have been teaching for about 15 years, and I love telling stories. And it's been exciting at this conference to hear so much talk of story in the past couple of days. We have heard that we need to be lovers of books, that we need to love learning, that God is the Word made flesh, and that we are designed for stories. But today I'd like for us to take just a little bit of time to talk about how we do that. If we are designed to tell stories and to help our students love stories and to give them a love for learning, and we all agree with that, how do we make it happen? How do we flesh it out in our classrooms? What happens on week four when we are tired and we don't have the time to prepare the lessons like we want to anymore and we hope to over the summer? What happens when the rubber meets the road? How do we tell good stories? Well, first, we looked at Jesus was an excellent storyteller. Sometimes he lectured, sometimes he preached, but sometimes he just sat and told stories. When he was asked what the kingdom of heaven was like, he said, it's like a hidden treasure. It's like a pearl of great price. It's like the sower and the seed. It's like wheat and tares. It's like the mustard seed. As he spoke in these stories, he met the people where they are. They lived in an agrarian society. So he spoke to them about nature, about farms, about things that were important to them, treasure, and what to do with it, talents, wheat, and work, and faith, and mustard seeds. He met them where they were with things that they knew. He didn't always talk to them about high and lofty things, but he talked to them about the things that they experienced day in and day out. He met them where they were and helped them to see things a little bit differently than perhaps they had before. He helped them to make a personal connection with the story. They could see themselves as the person burying the talent, or the person who had just that teeny mustard seed of faith. They could relate to the people who were in the middle of these stories. They weren't someone far away in a glorious palace. They were someone that lived everyday lives like they did. But yet these stories had deeper meanings. They weren't just stories that tickled their ears and made them feel good. They were stories that left them with questions, that left them pondering, that made them want to hear the stories again and again, which is why we still read them. The word is new every time we read it, and it pierces us like a two-edged sword. And so the more we read it, the more we learn from it, and it leaves a lasting impression. It lingers in our memories. Oftentimes we leave and we come to a conference or we leave a sermon and we hear these words that have pierced our souls. They have convicted us. They have taught us something new, and they linger with us and they change our behavior. But often if we reflect back on the sermon that you heard last Sunday, if you think very carefully about the sermon you heard last Sunday, oftentimes it's a story that you connected to. Not that sermons need to be filled with happy stories all the time that tickle our ears and fill us, but stories that challenge us and question us and apply truth to our lives and make us look at the world around us differently. So how do we tell stories well? As teachers, we get the gift of telling stories all day long. We tell stories in history and in Bible and literature and science and even math. We are storytellers. Now, the temptation for us as classical educators, having mountains of work to do and hours of prep before us every evening, is just to give a list of facts. It's easier, it's faster, it's what we're going to assess. Nuts and bolts, that's really all we want anyways. Let me just list it out for you. You can memorize it, drill and kill, or maybe if I'm having a really good day, drill and thrill, and then they'll be excited about what we're doing. And that works for facts. If I'm memorizing multiplication facts or dates or states and capitals or presidents, there are some things that just need to be memorized. That's what we do in the grammar school. We memorize things. But some things are more than that. There are pieces that are narratives, and they deserve to be told as a story. They deserve to captivate us, to wow us, to excite us, to instill a love in us. But that requires work on our part. So, how do we craft excellent stories? One of the first tangible ways that we can do that is by researching and gaining background information from multiple sources. Whether you have taught the lesson once or you have taught it 30 times, we still have to look at it fresh. We have to find a new way to look at this source of information rather than just pulling out old notes from the past, an old outline, the back of a history card, the story of the world. All fabulous resources. But instead, we have to look at it fresh. We have to find a new resource. Sometimes that means watching a documentary, watching a film over this time period or over this event, just because it helps you to see what the people looked like, how they acted, what they wore, what were they doing during this time. If you have a better visual of what you're about to teach, then it allows you to convey a better story. So you have to dig around and really find some good background information. Maybe that's in a commentary. Maybe that's in a textbook. Maybe it's in a film or a YouTube video or something that you can see that will help you to tell a better story. We also need transition details. Oftentimes, we know how the story begins, and we know the middle, and we know the end. And then we're tempted in our lesson to just keep it as a list of facts, because it's difficult to tie the two together. But in order to make it a narrative, we actually have to weave it. We have to practice what we are going to say, and we have to tie them together. Not that we have to invent or create information to fill in that gap, but sometimes we have to just craft a simple sentence that pulls us from one point to another and allows it to be said as a story. Not only do we need background information and transition details, one thing that is crucial to a good story is sensory details. This is where we as a culture are beginning to lack, because we don't take the time to tell many stories anymore. Instead, our lives are crunched down into a Facebook post or what you can fit onto Instagram in a hashtag, and we're getting really good at condensing. But we're losing the art of taking the time to really elaborate and tell a good story. And a lot of that is done through our senses. We have to stop and think, what were these characters smelling? What did they see? What did they taste? What did they feel? Now, sometimes that means that you have to take information that you've gathered from other sources and put it together. Often, if you read a history textbook, it's not going to tell you what the characters were feeling and thinking and smelling and tasting at the time. So let's say you're telling a story of Marco Polo. And you're telling your students about the time when he steps before the Khan for the very first time. And you want sensory details. Well, you're not going to find a text that's going to tell you them. However, if you know that one of the key pieces in the story of Marco Polo is that he brings back spices from the East, we can infer that there were spices around. Maybe he smelt them then. Whether he actually smelt them at that moment, I can still put that into my story, which then ties back later to my students this important fact that he brought back spices from the East. Maybe as he kneels before the Khan on these palace steps, he feels the cold marble on his face as he lays his forehead down at the feet of the Khan. Maybe as he looks up and the Khan asks who he is and he hears this strange tongue that he has been taken in and writing in his journals along the way. Maybe he sees the cloak and the sandals of the Khan and he reaches out and he touches it and he feels the silk. And he feels the smoothness of this texture he's not known before. And you tell your students and you draw out this moment of him kneeling before the Khan. Is that the most important part in the story of Marco Polo? No. But you can pull in all of these sensory details. What did he smell? What did he hear? What did he touch? What was it like at this moment when he had finally arrived in the East after all of those months of traveling through the desert? Here he was, following his father and his uncle, and he has arrived at this place. Taking the moment to settle there with your students and to pull in those sensory details and really make it into a story rather than a list of facts pulls them into the narrative. So we need background information. We need transition details. We need sensory details. We need a connection of interest. Just like when Jesus was telling parables, he connected the story to the things that the people knew. Something that they could identify with. We have to do the same thing with our students. We can't tell them all about things that they've never seen and never touched before that doesn't relate to them in some way. There has to be a piece of the story that draws them in, something that they can identify with in their world. Even if you're speaking about Egypt and the Nile, and they've never been to Egypt and they've never seen an Egyptian, still we can talk about the culture there, the climate, the pieces there that they can identify with. So we need background information, transition details, sensory details, a connection of interest, and never underestimate the power of a cliffhanger. It is definitely my goal to end as many lessons as humanly possible with a cliffhanger. If I'm to be completely honest, it's my goal in teaching to end every single lesson with a cliffhanger. It brings me tremendous delight because my students instantly begin to scream and moan and, no, don't stop teaching. We don't have to go to recess. We don't need to go to PE. Please tell us how the story ends. Don't stop. Don't stop. I love that moment. It's that great moment as teaching that you think, this is where it comes together. They love it. When Matt Whitling was telling us yesterday that our students should love learning, we should be able to see it on their faces. Because when they don't love learning, we can see it on their faces. And when they love it, when they're so enraptured in your story that they forget to play in their desk, and they're not nudging their neighbor, and they're not staring off into space, and they're not taking notes because they love what you have engaged them in, that is when we are most like Jesus in telling these stories. That's when our students are engaged with us and they are excited about us and they are hanging on every single moment that we are teaching them. For me, there's nothing better in the classroom. That's when the magic happens, when it all comes together and there's no place they would rather be than in my classroom at that moment, even though I teach in Orlando, Florida, with Disney World right around the corner. I compete with Disney World every single day in my classroom because the students come here regularly. And so how do I draw them in? I have to weave magic to pull them into the story. And a cliffhanger is a great way to do that. My students this year, I had a quite dramatic class, and my students this year asked on my birthday if I would give them a present instead of them giving one to me. I thought this an interesting request. And so I asked what gift they would like on my birthday. And they said they would like one day of no cliffhangers. I said, okay, fair. I can work this to my advantage. Yes. Tomorrow, I will give you a day of no cliffhangers. I will teach you all of your lessons in very concrete, very tidy, well-wrapped up lessons. And so I made sure that my lessons covered all of the content the next day, that they were somewhat expressive and dramatic, but everything ended with, and that's the way the story ends, the end. And every single time they said, that's the most boring lesson ever. Well, I'm sorry, that's what you asked for. You said no more cliffhangers. By the end of the day, they said, okay, we take it back. We never want to experience this again. Could you please bring back our old teacher, the one that we love learning with? Can you just give us another cliffhanger? And so we spent the entire second semester with one cliffhanger after another. Even to be so cruel as the last day of school, to end them with a cliffhanger. I mean, I teach the Old Testament. I end with the prophets, and there's 400 years of silence as they wait for the new Elijah. And my students look at me and they say, are you kidding? Really? On the last day of school, you're going to make us wait all summer long to find out what happens next? Yes, I am. And they love it. They love waiting for that anticipation, going home and telling the story and saying to their parents, I don't know what happens next. He hasn't told us. I have to go to school tomorrow. I love that email that comes in. The parent says, my child is sick with a fever, but they're determined to come to school today because they don't know what's going to happen next in your lesson. Or, I told my child that we're missing school tomorrow to go to Disney for his birthday, but he says he would rather come to school because I can't review the lesson like you can. Yes. And that's when we know we can tell a good story, when they're stuck on these cliffhangers. Now, to tell a good cliffhanger, you have to plan it. It doesn't just happen. And often that means you have to teach past your lesson. Our lesson ends in very neat categories. I'm only going to teach this point, and then I'm going to stop. But if I know what I'm supposed to teach tomorrow, I can teach just a little bit past what I was going to teach today and get just to the point of tomorrow's lesson, and then, oh, we're out of time. I'm sorry. We'll have to go to PE. No, we don't have to go to PE. We don't have to play dodgeball. Really, we can stay in here and we can learn. Oh no, PE is not my time. It's coach's time. We're going to need to go. But if I can teach past my objectives for the day and I can plan that cliffhanger, I can leave my students right where I want them in the palm of my hand begging for more. And that's where we as teachers want them to be. We want them to be enraptured in what we're doing. But it means we have to know our objectives. We have to know what we're teaching. If I'm only going to teach what I want my students to walk away with, they will walk away with far, far less. They will always retain less than what I actually teach them. So I have to cover more than I want them to walk away with. And I'm going to use that extra to draw them into my web, to pull them in bit by bit by bit, until once it gets to those pieces that I really want them to know, there's no place they would rather be than sitting in my classroom at that moment. And the cliffhanger is often the power to get you there. So you need background information. You need transition details. You need details about their senses of your characters. You need a connection of interest. And you need cliffhangers. You also need expression. If you're going to tell a story, introverts can do this as well as extroverts, I promise. You don't have to put on a three-ring circus to tell a good story. Your story can be told just in the expression of your voice, using eye contact, being excited in your tone, saying something very loudly, and then whispering to pull them in for effect. To talk about something very, very quickly and to build their excitement, and then to slow it down to emphasize your point. Even in just using your voice, even in not being able to move around, you can be able to convey an excellent story. I'm assuming you've gathered by now that in order to tell a good story, it requires extra study. It requires extra effort to go into your lesson. It doesn't mean that you can pick up that reference book or the back of the card and read it once and say, "I'm ready to tell a good story." You can't coast on last year's knowledge. Last year I told a good story, so I'm just going to open up to this page and I'm going to look at my outline and today I'm going to tell a good story. It just doesn't work that way. We have to put the effort into it. And we have to rehearse it. Oftentimes we even have to rehearse it out loud. Just like we tell our students before they're giving a speech, that you can recite it to a family member, or to an animal, or to the mirror, or on the car on the way to work. You're driving into school, into your classroom, and that's when you're rehearsing what you're going to say. You're walking down the hallway telling your story to yourself in your head. You have to rehearse the stories in order for them to come about. Now, right now it's just words. So I thought I would tell you a story. First, let me give a disclaimer that the story that I'm going to tell you today is really two lessons in our fourth grade curriculum. And so I realize that there are details that are left out, and I realize that there are minor characters who have been neglected. I apologize for their sake up front. But in order to convey the true meaning of what I want you to see today, I needed to put two pieces together to cover all of the elements. First, I would like to show you the story done in a productive way that meets all of the desires, covers all of the objectives, but maybe is left found a little wanting. Ahab was a wicked king. Under his rule, the people of Israel began to worship Baal. God sent Elijah to say that there would be no rain until the people repented. After 3 years, Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal to a test. Whoever could call fire from heaven first, he was the true God. The prophets of Baal prayed and cried to God all day, but nothing happened. Then Elijah prayed a simple prayer and fire fell from heaven, and Jehovah proved to be the one true God. Not bad. Covered all the key points. It's true, simple. That's an acceptable answer from my student. If I wanted them to summarize the event, you covered all of the key points. Yes. But some of you could have slept through that entire story. And at this point in the conference, it would be completely understandable. We're weary. Our brains are full. But instead, we want something that will capture our imagination. Something that will draw us into a story a little bit more than that. So if you will humor me, I'd like to try again. There once was a king named Ahab. He was a king of Israel who was more wicked than any other king who had lived before him. Not only was he a wicked king, he married a wicked woman, an extremely evil woman. And she worshipped the god Baal. Baal was the god of fire, rain, lightning, thunderstorms. And she was determined to turn the entire nation of Israel into worshipers of her god, Baal. So they set up altars to the god Baal all over Israel. And the one true God, Jehovah, was furious that his people had abandoned him yet again. So God sent Elijah, one of his two prophets, to speak to Ahab. Now, Elijah was from a small town of Tishbe, way out in the country, hadn't been to the city much before. And so he comes into the palace, dressed in his torn robe and his dirty sandals, and he walks into the marble of the palace, his sandals squishing on the floor, leaving little bursts of dust and dirt behind him. The entire court of the palace, all of King Ahab's officials, turn and look at this country man who had walked into the palace. And they said, "Who is he? Who welcomed him here? What does he want in the likes of us?" And he walks right up to the king. And he says, I have a message from the one true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He has said that there will be no rain upon this earth until you repent of your idolatry. No rain, no dew, no humidity, no mist, no nothing. And the people in the court began to laugh. What do you know? Baal sends the rain. Baal provides for us. Baal has given us everything that we need. You silly farmer, you know nothing about us. So Elijah turns to leave. The day passes. It's a beautiful day, the kind of day that we love, sunny and bright. Children are playing everywhere, not a drop of rain. Life is good. The next day, beautiful, sunny, not a cloud in the sky. Children are playing. People are rejoicing. Parties are happening at the palace. Life is good. Next day, same. The next day, same. Days turn into weeks. It's one sunny day after another. And then people begin to realize that there are no clouds. There's no shade. There's no refreshing breeze. There's no mist, there's no dew. The ground is beginning to dry up. Days turn into weeks. Weeks turn into months of no rain. The rejoicing outside is hampered a little, hindered even. But Elijah has gone away from the palace. God has taken Elijah to a brook. And he says, Elijah, you stay here while I do my work in Israel. You will be taken care of here. And yes, it is hot, and there are no clouds, and the sun is beating down. But Elijah has this brook to dip his feet into, to rinse off his head and refresh himself, to drink. God sends ravens to feed him, and he is completely taken care of. But as the sun begins to dry things out and the earth all around him, the little brook begins to dry up. And after 3 years of no rain, God says to Elijah, Elijah, go back to the palace. Go back and speak to Ahab. And go and tell him again that I am the one true God. I am the giver of rain. Go to him on my behalf. So Elijah packs up his belongings and walks back to the palace. Now this time they recognize him as he gets closer. And King Ahab comes out to see him at the palace and he says, you troublemaker! Elijah says, I am not the one who is in trouble with Jehovah. I warned you. I told you that you must repent. Do you still believe that Baal sends the rain? Did you not cry to Baal? Did you not ask him to relieve your land? Where is your God now? Let's put our gods to a test. Let's go up onto Mount Carmel. You build an altar to your God. I will build an altar to my God. Whoever can call fire from heaven first, he is the believer of the one true God. That shouldn't be too hard for you. If Baal is the god of lightning and thunder and rain, he should very quickly be able to send lightning from heaven. They thought it was an easy task. So off they go. Elijah, very patiently and preferring others and sharing his time, allows the prophets of Baal to go first. They build their altar. They lay the bull upon the altar and they begin to cry out to Baal. They pray to him. They scream to him. They pound on their chests. They cry and they sing and they dance and they cut themselves and they begin to make quite a spectacle of themselves. And Elijah's just standing by the altar. Elijah says, maybe you should call a little louder. Maybe Baal is on vacation. Maybe Baal went on a journey and he can't hear you, so try just a little bit louder. You know, maybe Baal's in the bathroom. just keep trying, keep trying, you go ahead. So he's taunting them. He's making fun of them as they're calling out to their God, as they're screaming and yelling. The entire day passes. And finally, as the sun begins to set, Elijah says, "That is enough. Now it is my turn." And he goes and he gathers 12 small, smooth stones. And he places them in a circle and he builds an altar. He places the bull upon the altar. And just to show off a little, he says, I need some water. Can you go down to the sea and fill up these pitchers? We've got some here, large pitchers, about 4 of them. Take them down to the sea and fill them with salt water and bring them back up to the altar. Strange request during a drought. Okay. So the servants go, fill up these 4 pitchers, bring them back, pour them upon the altar that Elijah has just built. He says, oh, go do it again. So they go again. That's 8 pitchers of water. He says, one more time. Let's make it 3 times. They go and they fill these pitchers of water from the sea. They cover them again. They come back and pour them upon the altar. 12 pitchers of water have been poured upon these 12 stones. So much so that there are now puddles around the altar. These people have not seen puddles in 3 years. And now there's water just lapping all around the altar. And Elijah takes a moment, looks at the scene before him, and he very patiently bows his head. And he says, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, show yourself as the one true God, and I as your true servant. Be known here today. Fire falls from heaven in that moment. He doesn't scream. He doesn't dance. He doesn't run around and do anything crazy. All he says is a simple prayer. Be known to your people. Show themselves to you. And fire instantly falls from heaven, devours all of the meat on the altar, laps up all of the water, and everything is consumed. So that all of the prophets of Baal and Asherah fall on their faces and say, He is the one true God. He is the Lord. Yes. So Elijah says, we see. Who has won the challenge today? Elijah looks up on the horizon and sees this very small, distant, white, little puffy cloud. And he smiles to himself and he knows what God is about to do. The wind begins to blow. He can smell the rain coming. The sky turns a light gray and then darker. The wind begins to rush around them, and then the sky turns black, and buckets of rain begin to pour down upon them as they go back to the palace. Imagine Ahab's excitement when he goes back to tell his wife, Jezebel. 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 And he says, see what has happened. And she says, yes, rain. I told you that Baal would send the rain. He says, no, Elijah's God has sent the rain. He sent fire from heaven too. He has won the competition and he has killed all of the prophets of Baal. You can see the fury well up inside of her. You know, on the cartoons where the face turns red and the smoke pops out of the ears and the head pops off of the shoulders? Something like that, I imagine. She begins to fill with fury. It's written all over her face. Elijah did what? He murdered all of the prophets of Baal? My prophets of Baal? You mean the troublemaker who has cursed us, who has caused a drought and a famine upon our land? He has killed my prophets? Oh, When I get a hold of him, I'm gonna hunt him down. And tomorrow I'll have to wait and tell you what Jezebel does to Elijah. Huh. Isn't that a great place to end? Oh, thank you. It's a very natural place to end when fire falls from heaven. The competition is won. Oftentimes, you'll tell the story, and the students will erupt right then. And they're just so excited. And then you keep telling the story, and you go just a little bit further into tomorrow's lesson, where she hunts him down. And Elijah goes from this mountaintop experience to he's now in the cave. And now he experiences God and the wind and the earthquake and the fire. But that's tomorrow's lesson. But I've set them up for that by stopping here, by them going home and saying, Mom, you won't believe what happened. Jezebel's going to kill Elijah, and my teacher won't tell me about it. Can we open up the Bible tonight, and can you find that for me? And Mom says, sure. Do you happen to know where it is? Yes, she was reading out of Kings. It's somewhere in Kings. Can you just read me all of Kings until we find out what happens? What does Jezebel do to Elijah? She's a wicked woman, Mom. There's no telling. And so we bait them with these stories. We prepare their hearts. We draw them in so that they see that these stories are real and they're exciting. Now, it takes a lot longer to tell a story like that than it did the first one. But still, my objective is the same. I want them to see the triumph of God, how he has proven himself to his people. But honestly, years from now, if I want them to remember the power of a mighty God, a well-crafted story is going to do that so much better than the summary I read you first. So, in order to do that, we have to make sure that we're giving background information, transition details, sensory details, connections of interest, cliffhangers, that we use expression, that it requires extra study, and that we rehearse it to ourselves, to others, that we practice. So storytelling in our daily lessons. Let's be realistic. Can all of our stories be like this? Maybe at some point. Definitely not your first year. Definitely not the first day of school. We have to start small. We have to pick one lesson and say, okay, this week I'm going to choose this lesson and it's going to be a great story. My other ones I'm going to put time and work and energy into, but this one's going to be the one that's going to be the best. I'm going to really focus on this one lesson and I'm really going to take the time to make it into a great story. I'm going to look at the background information. I'm going to think about the senses of the characters in the story. I'm going to tie it all together and I'm going to come up with a cliffhanger. And this story is going to be a good one. It's going to be the only one I can do all week. But this one is going to be worth it. And I'm going to make it one lesson at a time. I'm just going to focus on this one. Yes, there are others that could be done well, but there's time for that. We're not running a race. Well, we are in a different sense, though. We're not sprinting. We've got plenty of time to get there. And so we want to take our time and do it well. But we want to make good notes for the future. It's very frustrating to put lots of time and energy into a fabulous story and then next year pull out your file and not be able to remember what you worked so hard at. So write it down, even if it's you type it up word for word and you're so excited about that one lesson, even if, let's be honest, it's your one really good story in the whole school year. Let's say you just got to one. Life got in the way and there were so many other things that you were doing, but you told one really good story last year. Then by golly, make sure you have some really good notes on it so that next year you can have two really good stories. And you keep accumulating them year after year after year. Write your notes. Write things down. We tell ourselves we're going to remember. We don't. Next year rolls around and you come to the fall and you think, I don't have any idea about the content here. We teach so much rich information, we can't hold it all at once. And so when we come back in the fall, we need those notes to be able to lean on. So make good notes for the future. Build anticipation with your students. Oh, it's so much fun to bait them. Oh boy, I've got a good story to tell you today. Really? Is it a history story or a Bible story? Are you reading to us something in literature? Is it a math story? What are you doing? Can you tell us? No? Can't tell you? All I got to say is just it's a really good story. Oh, what's it about? Can't you just give us a little hint? Just saying it's a good one. Or, you know, I've got to check out and go to a doctor's appointment. Oh, that's too bad. Because we have history this afternoon. No, I asked my mom to change it. I did. Oh, can you tell me the story before I go? No. Good story takes a long time. Well, if I come in before school tomorrow morning, will you tell me the story then? I don't know. We'll see. We'll review tomorrow. Oh, the review is never the same. Build anticipation with your students. Tell them pieces of what's coming. Let them be excited about it. Enjoy the storytelling. It's okay to really get into it, to love it. Yes, I am the odd teacher in the school that other teachers come down the hallway and look in the window just to see what's going on. Because yes, my students will react and say, "No, don't." And I'm just nodding in the front of the room. The headmaster walks by and he's like, "Yeah, must be Bible time again." Or you've got the quiet student on the front row and you start to put in your foreshadowing and she goes, "No." And you stop and she says, "I knew you were going to stop. I knew you were going to get right there that you were building back up, but you weren't going to go all the way to the top." I don't have to teach them a story plot. Instead, they live it. They feel it. They're on that roller coaster. Build that excitement with them. Enjoy it. Love it with them. When they see that you love the learning and you love the stories, they will love it as well. Invite them into your world and enjoy it with them. Share with your colleagues. Oftentimes, we start to get nervous and we think, well, people are going to think that I'm silly if I told them that I really enjoyed this lesson that I taught today. It's true. But we are in a community of other weird people that love it too. So love it with one another. Be the first one to step out and say, "Oh, I loved teaching today. You wouldn't believe the story I got to tell today. And I told them this, and their mouths just dropped open. And so-and-so, who's always playing in his desk on the back row, even he was looking at me. Pulled him in. Yes, I did. It was so good. You want to hear the story?" Share with your colleagues. Talk to the other teachers who teach in your grade level, who teach in other grade levels, who teach in other parts of the school. Lower school teachers, tell the upper school teachers these exciting stories that you're telling. Invite them into the story. Invite them to come watch you tell stories. Go and watch other people who tell stories. The more you draw each other in, the more you share with your colleagues, the more it becomes a community. The more you enjoy it and draw upon it with each other. So say to them, "My students loved the lesson on this today. I loved learning so much about this today. I never knew this today." A great story doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be history or Bible or literature. It can be in math. As we're applying what they have learned, as we're teaching them this new skill, as I'm introducing a lesson and I want to really capture their excitement about what we're going to do, I can just start with a story, a short story, but a story that means I have to know what they are connected to. If all of my boys like Legos, I need to learn a few things about Legos or Star Wars or comics or Little Ponies, whatever it is. I need to know what they are interested in and draw them into that world. And often I can do that just with a math story. If I'm teaching on fractions and I've got boys that love to eat, I can say, "What happens when you've got four friends that come over to your house and your mom gives you this pizza that's cut into three pieces?" "Well, they don't get any." No. What are you going to do? How are you going to work out this problem? How are you going to solve these things? Giving them real things that connect to them. Stories don't have to be big and glorious. They can. God has given us big and glorious stories. They don't all have to end on cliffhangers, but they can. God has left us on a cliffhanger. He has told us to watch the clouds, that he is coming for us again, and that he will part them and he will come in glory. And he says, wait for me, watch for me, I'm coming back for you. If that's not a cliffhanger, what is? Every single day of our lives, we're waiting for that. He's showing us this is not where you belong. This is not your life. This is not where you are to be permanently. This is where I want you to work for now. Go, sow your seed. The harvest is ripe. Do what I have called you to do. Be fruitful and multiply. But look to the heavens, I am coming again. God writes a story in our hearts. He writes it in the creation around us. He writes it in every step of our days. There is power in our testimonies. But we as a culture are getting to where we just want nuggets. We just want sound bites. We just want a Facebook status or a hashtag. And we don't want to stop and tell the stories that God has given us. But that's what makes us different. That's what gives our words power. He is the word. And so we follow him by mimicking his word and by telling our stories. So I encourage you today, even if it's not a lesson that you're teaching, you still have a story to share. A story about something you learned today, a story about a piece of your life where God is working, a story about how you met someone, a story about how you encouraged someone, a story about how you are the hands and feet of the gospel. Share your story. Tell your story. Don't be ashamed of your story, but go and imitate Christ in all that you do and the words that you share. Thank you.